no science after you're gone. There'll be no crying. You'll feel blue, you'll feel sad. It is the best pal you've ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it. There'll come a time, now don't regret it. Oh, baby, look what you're doing. You're trying to drive me to ruin it. After you're gone, after you're gone away.
I'm Dennis Owsley. Welcome to the second hour of the Jazz History of St. Louis on Jazz Unlimited. And that was two of the Alfonso Trent Orchestra pieces. The first one was The Nightmare. That was recorded in 1928. And the second one was After You've Gone, recorded in 1932. The Nightmare has the first recorded solo by Hayes Pillars on tenor sax. And St. Louis trumpeter Irving Mouse Randolph was also on that band. On After You've Gone, George Hudson was on the band, along with the trumpet soloist Peanuts Holland, violinist Stuff Smith, and trombonist Snub Mosley. When the Alfonso Trent Band broke up during the Depression, the Reed section went to Cleveland, and on January 6, 1934, the Jeter Pillars Orchestra was formed. That band came to St. Louis later that year to play at the Plantation Club. Because the Plantation was closed for the summer, the band first worked at the Gingham Inn in St. Louis County, and then later on the road in Missouri and Kansas. And Eddie Randall was in the union and booked the band. Also, trumpeter George Hudson went west before the Trent breakup and joined the Kansas City-based Oklahoma Blue Devils. He got stranded one time in West Virginia with his band when a booker ran off with the money. George eventually came to St. Louis to teach and to join the Jeter Pillars Orchestra in 1936 or 1937. The Jeter Pillars band had, among others, Jimmy Blanton, drummers Joe Jones, Sid Catlett, and Kenny Clark, guitarist Floyd Smith, tenor saxophonist Jimmy Forrest, and alto saxophonist Chris Woods as band members during the tenure of the band. Here is Hayes Pillars remembering Big Sid Catlett and how the chorus girls actually would turn and bow to him after they had done their set.
And we stayed in Cleveland until July the 4th. We came to St. Louis on July the 4th, 34. And then we went to work for the people who owned the club plantation, but they had no summer place out in the county. We worked out there about 3 or 4 weeks and called Gingham Inn. and the business was kind of bad, so they booked us on a little tour with a girl called Jean Calloway. Other words, they kept us booked until September when we came back to open the Crump Plantation for the month.
We were just bumming around town, truthfully. And the word got in St. Louis that about Moat and everything, and then got in the word in St. Louis about the club closing. And Will Pillars was here with his own band, he and Jeter.
Right.
And they found out I was over there, and they sent me would I come over there. They told me they had a regular job, so that was good, you know. Yeah, salary was beautiful, $25 a week. So I said, yeah, I'll be a couple of send me a ticket, two tickets. Pillar sent for Walter Page. He sent for Dan Minor, trombone player. He sent for him. He came over.
Yeah, all the course girls used to bow to him. They, the course girls would take a bow and turn around and bow to sit with him because he could make them work, you know.
The Jeter Pillars Orchestra recorded four tunes in Chicago in 1937. They were I'll Always Be in Love with You and Lazy Rhythm, the ones that we're going to hear.
Thank you.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 2. I'm going to read you the personnel because a lot of them were St. Louisans. Ralph Porter, St. Louisan, Walter Crack Stanley, and George Hudson on trumpet, Ike Covington, John Bones Orange, St. Louisans on trombone, James Jeter and Charles Pillars, alto sax, Hayes Pillars, tenor and baritone, Chester Lang, piano, St. Louis and Vernon King on bass, and St. Louis and Henry Ross on drums, and Ted Smith was the vocal. It's obvious from these recordings that the Jeter Pillars Orchestra most likely was a sweet band rather than a jazz band. An interesting sidelight to the story was that when the Scarpelli brothers wanted to open the Club Plantation, they originally envisioned it as a mixed-race club, according to Kimball Dial, a saxophonist with Eddie Johnson. However, the police department scotched that idea. Around 1934, Eddie Johnson was forced out of the Cracker Jacks when he tried to bring outsiders, such as the great alto saxophone player Tab Smith, into the band. Johnson started a new band that was eventually called the Eddie Johnson Victor Recording Orchestra. He never recorded for a national label, but his band apparently cut almost any band they got into a battle of bands with one exception. The one band they couldn't beat was the Oklahoma Blue Devils, with George Hudson and Lester Young in a battle of the bands in 1933. The leadership of the St. Louis Cracker Jacks passed to Winfield Baker, Shorty Baker's brother, for a time, and then to pianist Chick Finney. They recorded for Decca in 1937, and one of the tunes they recorded was Echo in the Dark, with a trumpet solo by a man named Levi Madison, who was an early influence on Miles Davis. Thank you. I'm Dennis Owsley, and that was Echo in the Dark, played by the St. Louis Cracker Jacks in 1937. The personnel of the Cracker Jacks was Elmer Ming, George Smith, and Levi Madison on trumpet, Robert Scott, Walter, and Freddie Martin, and Ernest Franklin Reeds, Chick Finney piano, William Beatty Baskerville guitar, Kermit Hayes bass, and Nicholas Haywood on drums. Music on the various riverboats continued with bands led by Dewey Jackson, Charles Kreth, Fate Marable, Eddie Johnson, and the St. Louis Cracker Jacks. Salaries were cut because of the Depression. According to both Elijah Shaw and Eddie Randall in the same interview, Harry Lang, Ted Jansen, and Lou Chortcott were the only working white dance bands in St. Louis during the Depression. Blacks did have most of the dance jobs sewed up, even though they had no real union representation because they were only a subsidiary of the white union. There was one band formed in St. Louis in 1931 that didn't work on the riverboats. This was the St. Louis Blue Devils, led by Eddie Randall. He later ran a highly successful funeral business in St. Louis until his death at age 89. Randall was a force in St. Louis music for many years. No commercial recordings exist of the Blue Devils in the 1930s, but they were recorded non-commercially in 1941. These recordings will be played next week. The St. Louis Blue Devils played mostly on the road because there was much more money to be made there. During the 1930s, Eddie Randall's St. Louis Blue Devils began to garner a national reputation. They were also the first black band to have a regular radio show in St. Louis, broadcasting weekly over station WIL.
I didn't do too much studying. I just started playing. I came up in a musical family. Even in the country, my grandfather was a musician, and he taught everybody. I mean, everybody in his family. In fact, I remember we didn't have a lot of other people by me being born in 1907. That's a primitive according to today. And he had a large family, and they used to sing, and the neighbors would come to hear them sing. And so there were quite a few musicians in our family, just taught by my grandfather. In fact, he taught what they call shape notes. And of course, people of today don't use them. They use the spaces, line and spaces now, but we first learned how to read music by using the shape notes, which was taught to me, as I said before, by my grandfather. In fact, he taught the rest of them, and that little fellow there, you see enough of it, you automatically do it. So I came to St. Louis in about 1923, and I didn't try to play. I didn't get a horn until I was about 17 years old. I think I paid $17 for the horn. But I always loved music and hung around where there was music being played. I told you before that I always tried to do something for myself. I had a barbershop and tailor shop across from the skating rink on Garrison and Lucas years ago. And all the bands practiced over there, and they'd leave the instruments there in my tailor shop. And we just practiced. We would buy stocks. We'd buy what they call big sheets. And we would just have a bunch of guys in rehearsing. So the only band I ever played with really was with Warner Long and his band. And by being the type fella I am, I used to get work for Warner and his band. So in 1932, Carl George came to town. Did you ever hear Carl George? Yeah, well, he had played with Basie. He was the first black to play with Stan Kenton. And when he came to town, he was friends with some of the musicians in Long's band, and they wanted him. So Mr. Long wouldn't get rid of me because he knew I was getting over the work for him. I was doing the booking and everything. But the fellas start acting a little funny, and I says to Warner, I says, Warner, what's wrong with the guy? And he says, well, Carl George is in town, and he's had a lot of experience. They want Carl. I said, well, use Carl. I said, it doesn't matter to me. So he started using Carl George, and he played several places that I had booked. And the people began to ask him, so where is the other trumpet player? So he told him I was sick for a while, but after I was sick so long and hadn't died, some of them said, well, look,
if you can't bring that other trumpet player back, says, I'm sorry, we can't hire you. So there was a fellow playing in the band by the name of Joe Jonigan. Joe came to me and just asked me to start a band. This was in the fall of 32. I said, Joe, I don't know if I should or not. Says, of course, I was in a restaurant business and I needed to start something because I was going broke. And I said, you all are working plenty, aren't you? He said, no. He says, everywhere we go, they say, where's the other trumpet player? And he says, if you'll start a band, I'll help you. And he says, these people want you. They want you direct. They want you. And they like your song. I said, oh, you got to be kidding. I said, a man like Carl George, he says, these people are asking, where is the other trumpet player? This is how I started the band in 32. I was out here on what they call the hill. I heard that they were going to give a dance, and I was always hustling work. And while I was talking to this guy, he said, how many of you are there in the band? I said, seven. He said, what's the name of the band? Well, I always liked the Oklahoma Blue Devils. And so I just said, Seven Blue Devils. And that's how I named the band the Seven Blue Devils, and that stayed with us. Even after I had more, I dropped seven and just said, went by the Sailor's Blue Devils. Most of my work was in little towns. At that time, I started playing over WEW twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays at 12 o'clock. And then the letters would come in, and then I would go right around to these little towns and tell them to listen to the programs, and I started getting a lot of work. So I played a lot of one-night. I played so many one-nighters until we just wouldn't accept a regular job because at that time we were making more than you could make on a regular job. In fact, I've had people to leave regular jobs to play with me when I added men. Oh, Rex said when the cab was coming this way, and Rex was still there at the local hall in New York, said Rex told the guys, you know, when you hit the road, there's a band called the Sunset Royals, and you come across out this way, he says, they're going to out-clown cab. He said, when you get to St. Louis, he says, don't depend on how to hide a hole to get you through there, because a little band that plays just above a whisper, says, man, before you know it, they'll blow you out that back window.
I'm Dennis Owsley. Life was difficult for black musicians on the road. When the band was in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, the St. Louis Blue Devils were treated at first like men on the moon. Other black musicians that played with name bands had a much easier time. Leroy Harris was the lead alto player who played with the Earl Hines Orchestra. They traveled in their own Pullman cars, as did the Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway orchestras during this time. And here are Eddie Randall describing what happened at Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and Leroy Harris on the road conditions with the Earl Hines Band.
When I went to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, in 1936, when I first went there, it was terrible. And when I left there, though, they didn't bring lines into the different little club. We used to go up to the radio station and make a club. They would carry our instruments for us and everything after they got used to us.
Well, I thought it was quite pleasant. He really had things mapped out. Ed Fox was the manager of the band at the time, and so everything was pretty well scheduled. But then there are always times when things would mess up, where you'd be going to a date and find out that perhaps it should have been there a day before. And then there's times that you got there too soon. Everything worked out nice. Families and whatnot, so it was really good. I thought I was moving about first class.
In the late 1930s, Clark Terry got his start in music with Eddie Randall and Dewey Jackson. And here is Clark talking about Randall and Jackson as part two of Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis continues.
From time to time, Eddie would let me play with his band. I never did have an opportunity to go on the road with Eddie, but he always had much better players, you know. And I was just a youngster just getting started. Once in a while, he would throw me a gig. I played with him for a while, and the same thing with Dewey Jackson, you know. Because he always had guys like Wendell Black, Shorty Black, and his brother Marvin Black, and people like that, you know. And himself, he himself was a great trumpet player. And, of course, Eddie was, too. And Eddie had Miles, and lots of excellent trumpet players. And there were so many good trumpet players around St. Louis at that point.
You're listening to the Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 2 on Jazz Unlimited. I'm Dennis Owsley. That was Clark Terry talking about Eddie Randall and Dewey Jackson in his young years. One of the things that happened was that community bands continued to flourish in the 1930s, and they required teachers like Major N. Clark Smith and Elwood Buchanan in school and in the community. Mr. Buchanan, Miles Davis's teacher, talks about what they taught here. Then we will hear about a very important institution in the community, the Tom Powell American Legion Post. Around 1935, they formed a drum and bugle corps that was important for years, clear into the 50s. Clark Terry, Charles Fox, and Arville Shaw played in the corps in the 1930s, and later drummers Philip Wilson and Kenny Rice played with the corps in the 1950s. And here are Eddie Randall and Clark Terry talking about the Tom Powell Post.
Yeah, they wanted fundamentals back in those days and really be a good musician, you know, really want to be some. Even like, for instance, Andy Kirk, Count Basie, and all those fellas, he's a fraternity brother, man. Lunsford, Jenny Lunsford. See, those fellas played jazz, and it's just like a concert, you know, and the heavy music, you know what I'm trying to say. It just it was that, and that was instilled in your pupil.
You see, we started the Legion thing, as it was the son of the Legions.
Yeah.
This was before World War II. It was the son of the Legion. And I was the son of the Legion. And I was the oldest son of the Legion there. Yeah. And I had a 7-passenger car and a trailer that I carried my instruments in. And when we would go to these state fairs, I was the one that furnished the transportation. The 7-passenger Chrysler that I had, I'd have maybe 10 or 12 little guys in there and the instruments in my trailer.
Yeah.
And we'd go to Salem, Missouri, and anywhere, Salem, Illinois, anywhere where these... Clark Terry was with that, Liebling Bolden. Arville was one of my boys. They were there. We were kids under me, you know. That Tom Powell Post was important for years.
Yeah.
In fact, I used to practice the Tom Powell Post before we started the drum and bugle corps, try to have a band.
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, Charles Fox and I were in Tom Powell Drum and Bugle Corps in 1935 when we won the championship. I was a bugler and Charles was a drummer. And back in those days, in 35, I was just in high school, and I didn't have a trumpet at that particular time because Clarence Hyden Wilson, who was our band director at the time at Fishout High School, had run out of trumpets, and he had given me this valve trombone. He said, take this and get out of here. You can make more noise with it anyhow. So the closest I came to a trumpet at that particular point was my bugle at Tom Powell Post, you know, which is an old G bugle, a straight bugle without any pistons, you know. And because I had an opportunity to really learn how to do a lot of the tonguing and articulating and so forth and the proper embouchure buildup with the bugle.
Jesse Johnson, the husband of singer Edith North Johnson, was the promoter in the 1930s who booked the major black bands in St. Louis. Walter Dixon remembers one such promotion for Cab Calloway, and Johnson also promoted tours for Eddie Johnson's band, and those included tours backing Fats Waller. So we'll hear Walter Dixon talking about Jesse Johnson and Eddie Johnson talking about Fats Waller. I'm Dennis Owsley.
During the time I was working for Jesse Johnson, Jesse brought Cab Calloway to St. Louis. and drew the biggest dance crowd in the arena that's ever been in there. Over 18,000 people. And the man knew how to promote. I don't know where he got it from, but he knew how to promote a dance. He had an airplane to fly over St. Louis and drop out free tickets. Well, you know, if he would start dropping the tickets, I would say, at the arena area, it wouldn't be no time before the tickets would be downtown because the wind would carry them down there. Well, anyway, he drew so many people. Cab Calloway was so damn amazed himself. He said, where in the hell did you get all these people? He had never played before a crowd that big. And any time that Jesse wanted Cab to come to St. Louis, he came. Because he brought in the biggest promotion he ever seen in his life. He had never seen one like it.
He said, first of all, he's on station WLW in Cincinnati. Well, when we played Dancing Gavin in Annapolis and Columbus, well, he used my band, fill in.
Mm-hmm.
He played 20 minutes of an hour, and I would play the rest of the time, and he made most all the money.
What was Fats like when he played with your band?
He was very nice. Fats, very nice. One thing about it, he drank heavy. We have our uniforms in a little suitcase. He had a suitcase full of whiskey in it, and half pints, we call them then. That's what he'd take along, and no clothes on at all, but he still could do his job. He was great.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is the St. Louis History of Jazz. St. Louis trumpeter Shorty Baker began his career with the St. Louis Cracker Jacks and then worked with Andy Kirk and others before joining Duke Ellington. He was in and out of the Ellington band for over 10 years and once was married to pianist Mary Lou Williams. We're going to hear a set of three pieces of music. First, Ring Dim Bells, Shorty Baker with the Andy Kirk band, and then Black Beauty, Portrait of Florence Mills, with the Duke Ellington Orchestra in 1943, and then Art of Come Sunday, recorded in 1953 with the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Slow.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and we heard Ring Dim Bells with Andy Kirk, Black Beauty with Duke Ellington in 1943, Come Sunday with Ellington in 1953. The trumpet soloist was St. Louis and Shorty Baker. Alto saxophonist Don Stovall was born in St. Louis, and he recorded with many local bands before going on to New York. Here he is with a group of Kansas City musicians, and the tune is 627 Stomp. And before we hear the music, Eddie Johnson will talk about Don Stovall.
Don Stovall, great musician, he's a young fella. He was playing with Dory Jackson's band out of high school. And then I took him from Dory Jackson's band, and he started playing with me because I had Chad Smith doing most of the arranging, and he liked that. And we featured him quite a bit. And he stayed with me and took him to New York.
Dennis Owsley, and we heard 627 Stomp, and that's St. Louis alto saxophonist Don Stovall with Pete Johnson's band, recorded in New York in 1940. I'd like to remind you to stay tuned for the third hour right here on Jazz Unlimited following the station break.